answers and five for the future, each of which have set out critical issues that will determine America's ability to compete and prosper in the global economy. In each case, accelerated energy sector innovation strategies have been important portions of his story. In addition, I should add that Bill is a published novelist and the author of the Washington political thriller, A Good Day to Die. I'm not sure how large sales were on this. In fact, Googling it and Amazoning it did not yield high placements.
That's all you need to know. Right?
But I do see intriguingly this in a story from Roll Call. It's a nice apocalyptic story that involves the demise of the Capitol, Bates said with a smile. So with that, let me hand this over to Bill Bates, who will moderate our panel discussion and again field questions from the audience. We're hoping we can leave a few minutes for that. So as soon as Bill is ready, we'll let it rip. All right, thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
Great. Thanks. Can everybody?
Mic's not on.
Okay. Let's everyone can take a moment and stretch. Okay. Now can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Terrific. We'll probably have to send a dollar to Verizon every time somebody says that, right? Thank you, Mark, and good afternoon. Come on, we can do better than that. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
There we go. Make sure everybody's still paying attention. I want to thank the Brookings Institution for allowing me to be a part of this event today. On behalf of all my colleagues at the Council on Competitiveness, I want to say how excited we are to be partnering with Brookings on issues that are so critical to America's future. The Council is the only place where CEOs, university presidents, and labor leaders come together to ensure that America can prosper in the global economy. And we share the urgency that's being expressed today about energy security and sustainability. It was the case that these were a defining challenge for this country before the current economic crisis, and it will be that case once America is on the path to recovery from this crisis. The Council has an energy security, innovation, and sustainability initiative. We released a report last September called Prioritize, which identified key steps that the President and Congress need to take to put America on the path towards a secure and sustainable energy future. Two recommendations from that report: tripling America's investment in energy research and better leveraging federal research assets to drive energy innovation and economic development, are both echoed by the report that we're discussing here today on Energy Discovery Innovation Institutes. I'm very fortunate today to be joined by a tremendous panel made up of experts in the energy arena who are going to offer their perspectives on the energy challenges that this country now faces and how the Discovery Institute idea could address those challenges. What I'm going to do here is briefly introduce everybody, and then we're going to get right to a discussion. If all goes well, we should have opportunity for some more audience questions at the end of that discussion. I think you have everybody's full bios, so what I'm going to here do is summarize their entire careers in a sentence or two, and if they're still talking to me at the end of that, we'll start our discussion. To my direct left is Michael Schellenberger. He's a futurist, a political strategist, and the president of the Breakthrough Institute. Michael's going to help us understand the magnitude of the challenge that we face and what the appropriate response needs to be. To Michael's left is John Denniston. John is a partner with Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers and someone who is very familiar with the challenges facing startup companies and the challenges that they and the country as a whole face in the clean tech world. Our third panelist is Howard Burke. He's the chairman and co-founder of Konarka Technologies. Howard has lived the commercialization story, helping develop Power Plastic, a material that can convert light to energy. He also serves as a senior advisor to Good Energies, a leading global private investment firm in solar photovoltaic companies and wind developers. Sitting to Howard's left is Billy Glover. He's with Boeing Commercial Airlines. Billy leads the team responsible for developing and implementing a global environmental strategy for the company, including everything from design to greenhouse gas emissions. Next down the line is Bill Harris. Bill is the president and CEO of Science Foundation Arizona and works at the intersection of research and economic development, demonstrating that innovation is much, much more than what goes on in the laboratory. You know, we've heard the EDI proposal harken back to the land-grant college concept, and our final panelist, Peter McPherson, knows more than just a little bit about that. Peter is the president of the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges, which include 217 members and over 5 million students. Okay, so that's who we are, so we're going to jump right into what we know. Michael, I want to start with you. Speaking as a leading environmentalist, you've emphasized the urgency of the energy challenge and why innovation is so important. What else needs to be done to transition to a global clean energy environment?
Well, I think first some context is needed. So between now and 2050, the world is going to triple its consumption of energy. And if we want to get to where the United Nations IPCC says we need to get to in terms of keeping global temperatures under 2 degrees centigrade or less, we need to cut global emissions in half by 2050 and basically zero them out by the end of the century. So tripling global energy consumption, cutting emissions in half at the same time. It's been China, India, the rest of the developing world are going to contribute most of those new emissions, and they've made it really clear that they're not going to reduce their emissions or put a cap on their emissions until they reach our per capita emissions levels or Europe's per capita emissions levels. So that creates a particular challenge, which is that fossil fuels are cheap. It's not just a consequence of having a big fossil fuel lobby here in Washington. China built 1 to 2 new coal power plants a week last year and the year before that. It's doing so because coal is an inexpensive and easily available technology, not just for China, but the rest of the world. So if you want to deal with this emissions challenge and deal with the energy challenge, you've got to have a strategy to make clean energy cheap in real market, unsubsidized terms. And so I think when we start thinking about what is the strategy for the labs, what is the strategy for the DOE, I think President Obama and the Congress need to come together and agree that our goal is to make clean energy cheap. Now, that's a different strategy than my colleagues in the environmental community have largely pursued, which has been one of having fossil fuels represent their true environmental cost. The challenge of making fossil fuels cost a lot more is that neither the public nor governments around the world have been willing to do that. So, and even in places like Europe, when they've had a $40 price on carbon, which is a fairly high price, it wasn't enough to slow coal plant building or plans for coal plant building. So what we're suggesting is that in order to get those massive cost reductions, you need a great deal of innovation. The good news is that this America in particular is a country that's had a lot of experience getting those cost reductions. Microchips cost about $1,000 a chip in the late 1950s. The Defense Department bought so many of them through government procurement that the price came down to less than $20 a chip. I think we like to think that Silicon Valley was sort of invented by these great inventors like Hewlett and Packard in their garages, and they were great inventors, no doubt about it. But Hewlett Packard wouldn't exist if the Defense Department hadn't bought radios during World War I. Intel wouldn't exist if the government hadn't bought microchips. Xerox PARC, federally funded R&D programs, were responsible for the personal computer. Our point is that we didn't get personal computer revolution by putting a cap and trade system on typewriters. We didn't get the internet by putting a tax on faxes and telegraphs. We got there through direct government procurement. And what we find is that innovation is a large process that includes customers telling their suppliers how to innovate. And so R&D is important, but in the case of things like wind and solar, we had to get out of the labs into the real world. Denmark had to deploy large wind turbines offshore in order to get these very efficient, much cheaper sources of wind power. Same thing for solar panels. Japan had to outright buy solar panels. Same thing with hybrid technologies. It wasn't, as Thomas Friedman has often claimed, that it was just because Japan had greater efficiency regulations. The government worked very closely, and I think to the president of Arizona State's point, the government of Japan worked very closely with its auto industry on R&D, and it also guaranteed a market for those products. So if I was to emphasize anything, it's that R&D, the R&D proposal that Brookings has created is absolutely essential, but it's not enough. President Obama and the Congress need to also have a major commitment to deployment and government procurement of these new technologies.
Fantastic. Appreciate that. John, let me turn to you next. A similar question along, a similar vein. We read a lot about how much money venture capital is pouring into green tech or clean tech. What does the federal government need to get involved? I mean, we don't want to set up a competition, as Michael was just sort of hinting at. How do we strike the right balance?
It's a very interesting question. I've actually testified several times in front of congressional committees, and that actually exactly is a question that I got last year. And so here's the answer that I gave, is that the venture community and federal energy research are not in competition at all. They are synergistic. And so just as we've heard some examples historically of the interplay between federal research funding and commerce, let me add two additional examples. The first is the entire biotechnology industry. The biotech industry was funded by NIH's predecessor in an area that was then called genetics. Nobody called it biotechnology back in the 1960s and 1970s. And my venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, Kleiner Perkins, had the great fortune of funding two researchers out of UC Berkeley and Stanford, and we called the company Genentech. And that was the world's first biotechnology company, and we would not have had the privilege of funding those entrepreneurs if NIH's predecessor had not forward funded for a decade this area of research. Today, the biotech industry is an enormous industry employing a large number of Americans, and it's made a big difference to our economy and to our world, not to mention saving millions of lives. The second example is the internet. The internet actually owes its origin to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is an agency of the Department of Defense. And what DOD was doing in those days is actually something that is quite similar to Jim Duderstadt's idea, which is, let's do research for advanced military technologies in a collaborative fashion, not in a siloed fashion. And to this day, anybody who has knowledge of the history of federally funded research in the US points to DARPA as a beacon of success. You can point to the lasers, robotics, so many different industries, but I'll focus just for a second on the internet. So to encourage collaboration to make it more efficient, the people at DOD said, hey, can we create a network so we don't have to fly every time to Washington, D.C. or to Ann Arbor or various other different places for everybody to meet? Can we create a network where we can share documents? And that's exactly what they did. And so for a period in the 1970s and 1980s, DARPA funded research into that network, which they called the DARPANET. Through trial and error, they figured out the protocols and they perfected it. And again, my firm, Kleiner Perkins, had the great fortune of investing in two of the earliest internet companies, AOL and Netscape. And we would not have had that ability had DOD not forward funded DARPANET. And so I think it is very synergistic what federal research funding does. From the venture capital perspective, we love to see the research. We need more shots on goal. The other thing I will say is, separate and apart from the different functions federal research funding and the venture industry performed, I think it's important, as Jim did, to focus on the numbers. So Jim says that the size of the energy industry in the U.S. is $1.4 trillion. If you add transportation, it adds up to a $1.7 trillion industry in the U.S., $6 trillion worldwide. Last year in 2008, the entire venture capital industry in the U.S. invested roughly $2.5 billion, that's with a B, not a T, billion dollars in renewable energy research. And if you show me an industry that is investing roughly 0.1% of its annual revenue in research and development, I'll show you an industry that's not prepared for the future. We are so far off. We are, I would say, at least an order, Jim says an order of magnitude, I think it's more than an order of magnitude off, on the kind of research support that we need. There is no chance, I'll tell you, no chance that the venture capital industry can get us there alone. The venture industry will play a role, but it is the federal research funding is indispensable. So, at a macro level, where are we and why is the EDII idea such a great idea? We have seen in the IT industry what Moore's Law can do. And it's taken us from an era where the only computers that we had 40 years ago were large mainframe computers, the size of this room, that only the largest corporations in America could afford, to a time where now you have your cell phone, your smartphone, that is a computer. It has logic, it has memory, it has a display, it has a keyboard. It is a computer more powerful than many of the mainframe computers that we saw 40 years ago. How did that happen in 40 short years? It happened because of Moore's Law, because of innovation, a large portion of which came out of our university labs across this country. The good news is, in renewable energy, we're on a similar track right now. If you go back 10 or 15 years, you'll find that in that space of time, we have doubled the efficiency of virtually every renewable energy technology: solar, batteries, wind, biofuels, the list goes on. And that's before we had a concerted effort of our best and brightest and significant funding to deploy against the task. And so the problem we face right now is we don't have enough shots on goal. University researchers across the country are pleading to have the funding to create breakthroughs in the renewable energy industry, and they do not have the funding to do it. And so we need to significantly increase our research funding to make America competitive, to address the climate crisis, and to become energy independent. And the special idea that Jim Duderstadt brings to us today is, yes, let's increase federal research funding for energy. Let's do that. We desperately need to do it. But let's be smart about it. Let's create a multiplier effect. And so it is not just silos, individuals researching. Yes, we should do that. Yes, we need to do that. Great breakthroughs come through in that fashion. But let's create a multiplier effect by having the researchers, where appropriate, collaborate so we get the best and the brightest working together. That's the DARPA model. That was done very successfully. And I wholeheartedly endorse Jim Duderstadt's idea. That is what we ought to be doing in the energy field.
Thanks, John. Appreciate those comments. Speaking of collaboration and a shot on goal that seems to have scored, let me turn to Howard. Can you highlight for us how Konarka is an example of the type of collaborative research and development effort that's really central to the whole EDII proposal?
Well, first, let me thank the Brookings and the Metropolitan Policy Program for this opportunity. It's also a privilege in that Konarka sits here and I have the opportunity to present Konarka, but I can assure you that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other very innovative alternative energy and renewable energy technology companies, startups, present and future, that deserve to be in this seat along with Konarka. But Konarka is unique in a variety of ways. And before this policy statement was put forth, before this research was done, you know, I was out raising capital to start Konarka in the year 2000 and 2001 when you couldn't get a nickel from a venture capitalist. This was post.com and the telco bust. And I couldn't get but a few to even listen to me about energy technology, with all due respect, the Kleiners and others of the world. I'd like to share with you a perspective. I don't know how many folks have done serial entrepreneuring, but Konarka is my 13th company. And I've started companies in a variety of disruptive technology areas. In addition, I've spent my career in Route 128, where I am now in the Massachusetts area, but 16 years in the Silicon Valley and 3-4 years in the Midwest with startups and technology. So I may not look it, I'm 54, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I've seen a lot of new technology waves. What's different from my perspective is in those technology waves, whether it was the internet, which I participated personally and my company did, and to go to the earlier comment, you know, let's not tax the incumbent technology. Well, communications is federally taxed, and the Clinton administration made a wise move and did not tax the internet for communications, and that was a great shot in the arm for that technology. So I believe that government interventions, and when done smart, can really push innovative technologies quicker into commercialization, scale up not only in America, but deploy this technology around the world. The other comment I want to make, and then I'll highlight Konarka, is that in all of these waves of technology, I've seen innovation turn into commerce, commerce companies, and some of the leadership American companies amongst the Fortune 500, the Global 1000. But that did not happen in alternative renewable energy. In fact, America handed it over to the rest of the world. We had that leadership, and we lost it. And there are lessons, painful lessons, not to be revisited here. About sustainability, there was a question about sustainability. We thought putting lead in gasoline was a pretty good idea. It got rid of the NOx, boosted the octane. We thought putting lead in paint was a pretty good idea, stabilized the paint, last 30 years. Let's be deliberate about what we do. Let's not have another asbestos in insulation or lead in paint and gasoline. When we scale up these renewable energy technologies, not only should they be renewable, but they should be environmentally sustainable. Let's not trade one crisis for yet another. About Konarka, well, the heart of Konarka is innovation, and we're the contrarian. We're the guys that never get funded because we're so out of the box, nobody wants to give us a nickel. So I was going around the world saying that the future of solar was not just silicon, it was carbon. And at a time when 99% or more of solar was all based on the atom silicon. If you look in the periodic chart above silicon, what do you have? Carbon. What did Mother Nature pick 600 million years ago? Carbon. The year I was born, in 1954, Bell Labs discovers a photovoltaic effect in doped silicon, and we have the modern day solar industry. So today, the largest and wealthiest by market cap company in solar is one that isn't silicon, and it was innovated in our national labs in the 1970s, when that budget for R&D was way higher than what it is today. And that company is First Solar. And Konarka is based on a Nobel Prize recognition, a discovery that didn't come from the energy industry in material science. And I was looking for that intersection between energy and material science, and I found my co-founder, Alan Heeger, at UC Santa Barbara. And Konarka was formed by the spinning out of two state universities, University of Massachusetts, University of California, Route 128, Silicon Valley. Another unique aspect of Konarka is from the start, we collaborated with academia. We supported labs. We went out and partnered with leadership labs in the United States and as well in Europe to bring the best world scientists around this invention. If we're going to change the world, we're going to do it around the world. And then the other thing that we did is we tried to convince the national labs that this made sense. And their initial reaction was, this didn't make any sense. But I found a few scientists in the national labs who thought this did make sense. So instead of ignoring the national labs, I embraced them. And when they said no, I kept saying, please find a way to work with us. So Konarka spun out of state universities. We're the contrarian. We've received support from the Department of Energy, from DARPA, from Department of Defense, the NSF. We've received state support in Massachusetts and California. We've received state economic development support in Massachusetts. And we've raised $150 million of venture capital, private capital, corporate capital. And from day one, or near day one, I embrace large Fortune 500 companies. I know they can innovate, but I know they can scale and deploy technologies and make them global. And so Siemens owns part of our company. Total, one of the largest oil and gas companies, now owns part of Konarka. In addition, we partnered with DuPont almost from the founding of our company. So we found this, in my brain, this collaborative model where we would bring together the best scientists in the world, national labs, academic campuses. Now there are 27 around the world that are funded by Kanarka. I would raise capital, venture capital, from the leading venture funds in Silicon Valley, Route 128, as well as in Europe. And we would do all this in a collaborative fashion. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's what you're hearing this policy recommendation's all about. And it works, and you can use Kanarka as an example. And I believe not only do you have to raise the budget, absolutely, but invest it, not spend it, invest it wisely. And this sort of collaboration between national labs, academia, VC, innovative startup companies, working with Fortune 500 and 1,000 companies to gain scale around the globe, it works, and Kanarka is a demonstration of how well it can work. Thank you very much.
Terrific. We'll definitely get to some questions, I promise you. Thank you. It's a great story, Howard. Turning over to Billy Glover. Billy, as the large company representative, if you will, at the table or tables, what's in it for Boeing to push for greater innovation in the energy arena, and how are you going about doing that?
Thank you. Let me start off by saying I'm going to focus on commercial aviation. And if you think about it, we have some really unique energy challenges. We have several million parts, 35,000 feet in the air, flying in very close formation, and about 500-600 miles an hour. And we need to do that economically and efficiently. Flight for me from Seattle last night, less than 50 gallons of fuel to get me here. What other mode of transportation does that? None. So we've been working on fuel efficiency, basic conservation, through improved engine, airframe technology, structures, materials, aerodynamics, and so on, since we started. We have 70% improvement in vehicle efficiency since the dawn of the jet age, since the 60s. So we've been working on efficiency, but what we realized about 3 years ago is we have a new opportunity. The problem is our old paradigm is tied to fossil fuels. So while we generate 8% of GDP worldwide through commercial aviation, commercial aviation is associated with 2% of global CO2. We need to figure out how to stop that from growing and turn it around. So we need to keep working on efficiency, but that's not enough. The only other physical way for us to do that is to fundamentally change the fuel. And so about 3 years ago, we were complete skeptics that that could ever be done. We have such extreme technical challenges that we need to meet we said, that's not possible. But then we saw some things that kind of said, well, maybe we should ask around. So we started 3 years ago on this kind of journey of discovery and said, well, maybe there is something here. But one of the first things we did was we decided we weren't going to try to compete in the fuel production space. Instead, we were going to collaborate in a new way because we felt that we needed to get something going. It's probably a distributed model of lots of winners, not just one. And the only way that people are going to talk to us if they feel that we are facilitating and not competing. So we set out to do this, and let me tell you, I have had some very interesting discussions with some of our contracts folks. You want to let a contract to a university to do some studies on sustainability, and you don't want to retain any rights to that? No, because if I retain rights, it has no value. It's something that has to be put out in the public domain so that we can get criteria in place so that we are developing sustainable biofuels, not just biofuels that people have questions about, and that it's credible, it's third party, peer reviewed, that sort of thing. We've been successful in getting to know the space very well. We have now pretty much proven all the technical challenges. We can actually produce fuel that is better performing, higher energy density, lower freeze point, which is kind of important when you're up at 35,000 feet. And we have done this in a way that we now have lots of people ready to take the next steps towards commercialization, scale up, and so on. There's still a lot of work to be done, but what we need is, was said before, outcome-based things where we have R&D that's now matured, we're ready to deploy. There's a lot more work to be done. We're working with Arizona State on algae, which is a little longer down the road, but has great promise. So productivity improvements, possibilities. And this is a way to create jobs, improve the environment, sustain the economic benefits and the social benefits from commercial aviation. And we think we have somewhat of a unique challenge, and we need some help to make that come true. We're not like a lot of other modes of transport or a lot of fixed emission sources. We don't have that many opportunities to fundamentally change our source of energy. So this is something we've been working with federal labs, universities, public and private companies to do. And this collaborative approach has enabled us to move very quickly. And so I think what's proposed here in terms of an approach to federal research is right in line with what we've had recent experience on as being very beneficial.
Fantastic, thank you. Collaboration is quickly becoming a key word down the row here. Bill, let me turn to you. You've had the opportunity to study the research community from inside government with NSF, overseas with Science Foundation Ireland, at the state level now with Science Foundation Arizona. A key tenet of the council's work has always been that innovation is no longer the tenet of the lone researcher in the lab, but it's cross-disciplinary, it's collaborative, it's now global. I'm curious, does the budget shortfall that a lot of states now have offer a unique opportunity to explore novel partnerships like those proposed out of the DII with the federal government as a catalyst, for example?
Well, let me do one thing first. I think the simple sure. answer to that is yes, especially in these times. But I think the premise of the meeting today, and even just the words Discovery Innovation Institutes, I think they're the right words. I know that there'll be people that'll be concerned about individual investigator grants, and that's been an issue for a long time. I think what Dr. Crow said earlier, and what Jim Biederstadt mentioned as well, we have major societal problems. And I don't think that there's a better sector or a better institution to solve these problems. My concern, I guess, as an observer living in Europe for 5 years and watching the U.S., is a growing breakdown in the political dialogue and the political consensus of getting things done. We used to get things done. We've created a situation where when you talk about doing something like this, you're accused of picking winners or losers. And what we're talking about is open competition and collaboration. And one of the things, when I went to Ireland, I had the opportunity in starting this Science Foundation there, is they had pretty much a green field. There was not a lot of history. And what I found from talking to industry, from the biopharmaceutical side to the optics side to the computer chip side, is basically what Billy said. They want to work in a new way and collaborate. The model where we dominated the world uniquely after the 1950s and we had a monopoly in so many fields is gone. And yet in some ways, we think we still have a monopoly. We forget we've lost Bell Labs. We forget we lost a lot of other labs. And again, when I talk to people, and we now have experience in Arizona of getting companies who are put there for manufacturing who want to figure out how to work with the universities. Now, Arizona State University is a relatively new university. It didn't do research when Boeing started, so there's not a lot of collaboration that's going on there. We have begun to stimulate that because there are unique assets in that state. So I guess the thing that I would like to encourage some discussion about is the recognition that first and foremost, our universities have a human capital talent pool that's second to none. We are probably not deploying it as well as we could. We probably don't have the incentives that are in place to allow these things to work as well as they could. It's not the university's fault, it's the incentive system that we've created. And I think when Dr. Crow talked about just counting publications or dollars, we've created a system that doesn't talk about economic development and bettering the communities and bettering the states or bettering the region. We've got disincentives. We're trying to work with New Mexico and California. Very, very desirable goal for regional cooperation on energy. We want to do that. The scientific communities want to do that. The legislators of the various states have rules. We have boundaries that we have to live within. So I think, to go back to your question, I think if there's a federal role here, it could remove some of the friction that exists in local legislations about you can only work within the state. There are no boundaries in these kinds of problems. We've got to work across the states. The other thing that I think would be good to talk about is the desire and the important role of the federal government. We have, over the last 20, 30 years, given the impression that government is bad. Well, I think we've had enough examples up here that have shown what government can do that's well. And as a society, we have to begin to recognize that government can be a very powerful unifying force if we can figure out how to work together. I'll finish with talking about the land-grant model, which I have been a fan of forever. I'm not going to take your time, your words. But I have been frustrated. Okay. I have been frustrated for years that concept has not been modernized. The land-grant model is singularly the most effective transformation of a society from an agrarian society to a modern industrial society. And it works so well, it seems obvious that if you took that model and applied it writ large, you'd have huge success for our society. I actually think that's kind of what Dr. Crowe's doing. He calls it the New American University. But he is so connected to the society that he's trying to solve problems. Some people will look at that and say, well, that's not what universities ought to do. I think that's precisely what universities ought to do. And then the last point is the intellectual property. What I found very impressive in the report, Jim, was they focus on exploiting intellectual property rather than framing mountains around it and preventing the universities from actually getting it used. That's been my frustration in dealing with some things in Arizona, is getting intellectual property used. Again, ASU has listened to my complaining and their own concerns and has new processes in place. As you mentioned in the report, the new processes at Berkeley and so forth. I think we need to go to the future and innovate and figure out how to define the future, because we did that in the 60s and 70s. The world has caught up with us. They're doing everything we can do. So if we don't learn to work together in new ways, regionally and through these institutes, I think we're missing a huge opportunity. And I commend the leadership for your vision. And this probably doesn't even, this model, I think, Jim, doesn't even limit itself to energy. It could be used in other areas. And I think what you have done is seeded the possibility of a new paradigm for how research could be done and how the universities could truly transform the society the way they did at the land grant. So thank you very much.
Great, terrific, and you, of course, teed up my next question perfectly there. Peter, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to the accusation that the land-grant university model is a good one here, and also wanted you to build on maybe a bit of what Nostalgic is working on in the energy innovation area.
Well, when you look back at what this model was about starting 100 years ago or so, the concept was that you would link research with the farmers and education. And there are, of course, lots of differences, but what you had was a whole lot of people out there that were users of the technology and also told back to the researchers what they needed and what the problems were, that it was back and forth. There's some real comparability to what we have here. We're talking about all of us as citizens using energy. We're talking about lots of players. The land grant system was not a command and control system. It was people working together, lots of disagreements, and to go back to the Mike Crowe point, it was an outcome system. Farmers didn't care what you thought if they couldn't grow more corn out of what you told them. And it was the feedback was reasonably quick, actually. Now, more complex, different society, and so forth, but I think there's something really there. The way I look at this, to step back for a moment on this general concept, I think that there's going to be lots of ideas out here on what the federal government should do, what we should do in this society. There's ideas on the Hill. There's members of Congress that have put forth some thoughts. I think this concept has embedded in it some key principles, as do some other proposals. And I think we need to keep these principles in mind. In Washington, nothing ever survives as it was originally proposed anyway. So we're going to go through lots of reiterations, and we just have to keep our eye on what are the key points here. And as I see it, there's point one, that you've got to do something structurally. It's not just the way we've been doing it. And I believe this sort of loose structure, we made the parallel land-grant system, but the loose structure involving a lot of people where you link in a not very tight way, but structurally somehow, industry, government, and the universities. To me, that's principle one. Principle two is you've got to free up with resources and some changes in structure and behavior and so forth. You've got to do a lot more with the universities because they are deeply interested in it. Lots of stuff going on now, but there's a little bit of siloness to it too. So principle two is great augment of the universities. It's land-grant schools, but it's much beyond. It's the bio stuff, it's nuclear, it's wind, the whole list. Principle three, we've got to put more resources, ease of effort, and so forth into making the research into commercialization work better and faster. Of course, that fits into structure, but that's a sub-problem within it that we need to be sure to address. And principle four, we've got to have a lot more resources. But I agree with the point made several times here. The answer isn't just more money. It has to be in the context of this whole. And the way I like to look at this is that we are doing the GDP of this country into health, healthcare, and energy are about the same. But we're putting, in terms of federal government resources, depending on how you measure it, 5 to 8 or 9 times more into healthcare. Now that doesn't, I'm all for the NIH budget. I think it's very important. But I think that we don't have the problem properly sized when it comes to federal government research in this area. So those four principles, and it seems to me if we can keep our eye on those, this concept, very sophisticated, very thoughtful, and what Jim and his colleagues and Gordon and Michael have done with this, I think, is just very impressive.
Terrific. Thanks, Peter. And we're going to get to some audience questions, but before we do that, let me just ask sort of a lightning round series here. Does anyone have any 1 minute or less comments about what they've heard from the other panelists here? Howard?
Since we're in the Beltway, I feel compelled to say this. I'm a Republican from New Hampshire. I was part of McCain's energy team. And my friend Andy Karsner, who was our assistant secretary 2.5 years ago in the Bush second term, he and I, late at night, would talk about the very thing we're talking about now, how siloed the national labs were, the disconnect between the marketplace and the researchers. This is not Republican. This is not Democrat. This is not liberal. This is not conservative. We all see it. All of us that know and are pushing for a new energy paradigm in the United States and this energy transition, whether you're Republican, Democrat, independent, left, right, when you get into the guts, you see how it needs to be changed. So it's not just about more budget, which is absolutely necessary. No matter what your political flavor, we all see this change is necessary structurally in how we fund energy research, deployment, scale up in America.
Great. Michael? Yeah,
I was just going to add that. I mean, I think we have to have a higher tolerance for failure. I mean, I think when you go to Silicon Valley, you know, good VCs will say that the point is not to avoid failure, but to learn from your failures. And I think that I think that the Golden Fleece Awards has been such a disservice in many ways. You know, I mean, it's like, So many ways we think we take these examples and we kind of go, oh God, here's just another government failure. But of course, if you go look at, and I'm sure you know, many of the investments that Kleiner Perkins makes don't work. You're looking for some really big successes.
What?
I know.
Not the ones he makes.
Yeah, no.
It's partners that make the mistakes.
And I think as part of that, we need to also understand what our goal is. So, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that gets thrown back at us a lot when you talk about the need for government procurement and deployment is people say, well, look at SynFuels, look at ethanol, those programs failed. Well, in fact, in the case of SynFuels, the mandate was to produce an alternative to oil that, for $60 a barrel. And they achieved that. Now, the problem was that oil went to $10 a barrel. But everybody remembers it as colossal failure. And I think the point is, and I think other people have warned against, well, we might have some unintended consequences of these technologies. We're not going to avoid failure. We're not going to avoid unintended consequences. The point is to keep moving the ball down the field and to continue innovating and keep supporting innovation despite or because of those failures. And the one example I would just use is that I think in the case of SynFuels and also in the case of solar deployment in places like Germany, they set production targets or they set deployment targets, but the focus hasn't been actually on getting the innovation you need for consistent price declines. So I think that the metric that we ought to be using is, are we continuing to advance the technology? Is the price continuing to come down? If not, why not? And that might be a moment to discontinue.
Great, thanks. John?
Yeah, the president's talked about a number of stark realities that we're facing. Let me emphasize one other that I think was implicit in a lot of what's been discussed this afternoon, but I want to make this abundantly clear, that we today do not have the technologies that we need to address the climate crisis and to become energy independent. We don't have them. I spoke before about the Moore's Law analogy in renewable energy, and that is true, but that's a step on the path that we need today. We don't have the technologies today, and if we stand still, we're not going to get there, and we will be overwhelmed by the climate crisis, and we will be dependent on foreign sources of our energy. And if that's where we want to be, then let's not be creative. Let's not do the EDII. If we want to solve those, then we have to be creative. The other stark realization that we need to come to is that this is not 50 years ago, where America is the leader in technology innovation across the board in every industry. Europeans, South Americans, Asians realize it's technology innovation that first and foremost explains the American standard of living. And we are now in a global race to lead the green tech revolution, which I believe will be the second industrial revolution. And if we aren't creative, if we aren't bold, we will not lead. And as Jim said before, we'll be importing a different kind of energy source. It may not be crude oil, but it may be batteries and it may be solar panels. I don't think that's the path that we should set ourselves.
Great. Bill?
Just go back to the original discussion of the DII. There may be a spinoff here that's possible because as you begin to distribute these things, one of the things you have the opportunity to do with federal leadership is to begin to engage state governments in new ways. And I think state governments for the last 50 years, for the most part, have not had a responsibility for R&D. By and large, they don't understand it. They think that's a federal thing. And I think if we're going to get true innovation, we want to be able to have a more coherent approach to this across the country so the universities are better understood in their states, that K-12 is better understood, and that our workforce is better understood. And I think that the disconnects are partly because, I've concluded, partly due to this lack of an understanding of R&D at the local level. And at the federal level, we understand it. We understand why we want great universities. But you get to some of the states, and it's really a huge disconnect. And they'll talk about government money for schools. That's just bigger government. So we have to really use this kind of a tool to really transform government across the country and not have everything centralized in Washington. I would encourage you to think about models that would have things here, but take advantage of the talent. This is no longer a small country. There are 300-400 million people. Sure. And if you have it all in D.C., it's going to be very slow, and it's going to be very unable to solve the distributional problems that we need to solve.
Great. Billy, did you have 60 seconds?
I was just going to comment on I don't think we've talked enough about the urgency. And while the concept we're talking about here is going to take time to mature, as somebody said, it's going to change a lot as it, you know, gets followed. But there's good work that's been done in the last 10, 20 years in R&D that's not in the marketplace today. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out why that is and correct that very quickly, because that's loss. That's loss that we'll never recover. And we need to take some of the principles we're talking about today and find ways to stair-step into that full concept that's offered.
Great. Peter, do you have a last
thought? I was going to say that in addition to the work that we do here, we need to be fostering and encouraging other major users around the world. After all, to some extent, this energy market is fungible. And if China and India, emerging countries, Europe can't figure out how to do this, it just won't work either.
Terrific. Well, I know we have about, I think, 10 minutes left, if I'm looking at my watch correctly. So let me open it up to the audience, and we'll start right here in front.
I'm Mitzi Wertheim with my energy conversation, which I started 4 years ago with funding from the Defense Department to get, and our mantra is listen, learn, connect, share, collaborate. That's not DOD behavior. It's very hard to get them to behave in that way. My question for you is, how are you going to tell the story that I think has been so rich today to the rest of the country? It's bloody complicated. Most people have an instantaneous attention span. One of the best things I've seen recently was the film that was shown at Davos, which was about 3.5 minutes, on just the water problem. And it had no words. It's very hard to take the complex stuff you're talking about and present it to the nation. But by God, if they don't feel it, nothing really will happen.
Howard, you want to take that?
Well, my answer in part to that question is listen to our president. I think President Obama has got it. I think he understands it. As an example, how many here have ever heard of Polaroid Corporation? If you haven't, you're probably young. But the fact of the matter is, when really? Obama talks about, and when he hears these jobs aren't coming back, dismiss that. That isn't true. So when the president visited a company in Ohio, I think it was, that makes gears for wind turbines, Konarka purchased the flagship coating plant of Polaroid. And today we're making plastic solar films in that plant, hiring back those 300 employees. So anyone tells you this is not an engine for economic development, this is not an engine for job growth, and that the future is both innovation and job creation, then they're not listening to our fine president of the United States. So first, how's the nation going to hear about it? Let's listen to our president.
Chuck?
I think that is a fantastic question, and I'm very, very concerned about that. I think that's one of our top issues. Let me give you, I don't know the solution to that, other than sessions like this happening and us getting the word out. Unfortunately, the green industry is not as well financed as other industries that are threatened by these changes that are coming, and that's a numbers problem, and I don't have a solution to it. I read over the weekend a very interesting study where the American public, roughly 45% believe that climate change is real and man-made. 45% of the American public believes that, okay? If you look at researchers in the climate scientists, experts, okay, the percentages are 90%+ believe climate change is real, 80%+ believe it's human-caused. But if you narrow that, this is, by the way, a survey that went out to 10,000 researchers worldwide. If you focus that on those who are really writing, who publish research on climate and climate change, 97% believe it. Okay, so look at that dichotomy where you've got 90% of the world's experts believing climate change is real, and we better do something about it. Less than half that, 45% of the American public. We have our work cut out for us. You ask a splendid question. I'm very concerned about it. We've got to get on it. It's a problem. It's a huge problem.
All the way in the back. And this will be our last question, I'm afraid.
Jim Hurd, Green Science Exchange, San Francisco. I've been watching for years now the discussion here in Washington, the tussle on Valley of Death issues. And, you know, Tom Friedman and others have said we can't compete on leading on energy technologies if we don't address Valley of Death issues that get us between research and venture funding and increased corporate funding. And I am just not hearing anybody hardly talk about it. I've written some articles on it, but I'd like to hear what you all think about, and I'm concerned with who we have in the Department of Energy and who we have as our Commerce Secretary, mm-hmm. that a lot of people are not particularly interested in funding and dealing with and coping with Valley of Death issues, which for people who are not familiar with it is, you know, this crossover between what's funded for research and what gets ready for venture capital and corporate investing. So I just wanted to ask that question. Yeah.
Great, good question, Michael.
Well, it's a great question. I think also, I mean, I think it gets to this issue of why aren't the labs able to get us the technology breakthroughs that we need in order to have cheap, clean energy? And I think it's, to be fair to the labs, I don't think that's been their mandate. I mean, they've been focused on, you know, 20, 30 years out. And I think private VCs are focused on 1 or 2 years out, but you've got this, the 2 year to 30 year window that's not being invested in. And I think that, again, I think I worry a little bit that our focus is so much on lab research, university research, when really the big breakthroughs in terms of bringing the price down in terms of wind and solar happen through deployment. And it's also obviously the case with other technologies like radios and microchips. So I think if you want to get across that valley of death, you've got to be realistic that you've got to get the economies of scale that are required in order for those technologies to become much cheaper in absolute terms. And I think part of the reason you just haven't heard a lot of talk about it is partly ideological. I mean, there's just been this sort of knee-jerk reaction to, well, the government shouldn't pick winners and losers, and that would be the, like, as though picking winner technology winners would be the worst thing in the world, you know? I mean, and also, it's interesting, we just did focus groups in Indianapolis and Richmond on the state of the economy, and literally we would ask people, what should the government do about the economic crisis that we're in? And people would literally draw a blank. People were just kind of, they had no answer to it, and when we would sort of remind them of the U.S. government, the railroads, the highways, the microchips, the internet, it was like everything changed for them, but it's sort of like collective amnesia about the U.S. government's role in technology deployment and innovation.
Peter, do you have a thought on that?
This area is where there isn't very much money available, relatively speaking. I think there needs to be more research money. There is venture capital money if something is commercialable, but we don't have much for the gap. And it seems to me that that's part of what we need to do here. There needs to be competitive grants money to be able to do it. I think the labs have got a huge leap to get into the commercialization business. And universities have something of a leap to do it better.
Howard, did you have a final thought?
Well, again, I play venture capital too with Good Energies. And there is this valley, and when Fortune 500s meaningfully spent money on R&D, they were able to fund within these major corporations getting that bridge over that valley. And their cost of capital and expectations were different than venture funds and the risk reward. So I believe with Fortune 500 companies not playing that role any longer in the Bell Labs and for the most part, the IBM labs, Watson labs, not what they used to be decades ago. I really think this is important for the federal government to step in. And I give the example of MIDI in Japan. The Japanese government does this excellently. They bridge that innovation to scale up. It's called MIDI, it's called NITO, and it kicked our ass for about 2 decades. So, yes, there is a role for federal government. My lord, you know, I'm from Live Free or Die, New Hampshire, and I study under Milton Friedman, and I'm telling you there's a role for the federal government to address it.
Well, there, fantastic note to end the discussion on. Well, please join me in thanking our panelists for... And I guess I turn it back over to Mark.
I don't think we want to use all the lessons in Japan, though.
Yeah.
Great. Well, that was very, very helpful. And I think we heard they're both...
You want us up here?
We heard strong conceptual support for the need for some sort of catalytic, multidisciplinary engagement of the federal government in energy innovation, as well as some suggestions for implementers. So the devil's clearly going to be in the details, but... To round out the day now, I'd like to introduce one of our most special guests in some ways, one who is uniquely well-positioned to provide some summary reflections this afternoon. This is Dr. Jeff Wadsworth,
president and CEO of Battelle Memorial Institute. Battelle is based in Columbus, Ohio. It's the world's largest nonprofit research and development organization. And in that capacity, Dr. Bosworth manages or co-manages six major national laboratories for the U.S. Department of Energy in partnership with leading universities and other industrial partners. Battelle, in this respect, lies in the center of much of the present and future innovation activity we're discussing today. And indeed, Battelle is increasingly utilizing a variety of unique partnerships amongst industry, universities, and the national labs to move discovery and innovation into the marketplace as rapidly as possible. As to Dr. Wadsworth, he has special knowledge of these issues, I'd say. As before taking over as president and CEO, he led Battelle's Global Laboratory Operations Division and oversaw Battelle's management of its DOE labs, as well as oversaw the startup of an entirely new renewable energy laboratory in Kuala Lumpur in partnership with the private sector. Before that, Jeff worked at Stanford University, Lockheed Missiles and Space, and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He's also served as director of Oak Ridge National Laboratory. So what better way to wrap up our discussion today than by having Battelle's Dr. Wadsworth share his reflections on what we've heard today. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jeffrey Wadsworth.
Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you, Brookings Institution, for making today available to all of us. And I won't thank anyone else except my dear colleague, President Gordon Gee, and it's always fun to meet him outside of Columbus, as well as our work together with OSU and Battelle. Boy, there's a lot of things I could reflect on. Battelle was created in the will of Gordon Battelle in 1920 to solve the Valley of Death problem. He was an early observer of the fact that research at universities wasn't making its way into the marketplace and dedicated his personal fortune, and then his mother did, to the creation of an institute designed to do that. I love this comment about stapling a green card to a diploma. I came here for 1 year in 1976 and never went home. I'm legal. But they sure didn't staple a green card. It took a few more years than that. Battelle's tagline is the business of innovation. We operate about $5 billion of R&D annually. The first comment I'd like to make before I summarize is, and there was a very good question about it from the back earlier, why is this such a tough problem? And in my mind, there are two sort of triads of difficulty. The first is you can't discuss energy without discussing national security and health. They're inextricably interwoven. There are great historical examples. I won't go into them. But you have to think about all three together. And then within energy, you have the complication of environment and economics, not even to mention a few more that we heard today, Jim, that also make it very complicated. So this is a tough problem. That's why it's not being solved. But America's a great, great country, and we should take on tough problems. And we've heard a lot of suggestions today. The second point I'd like to make is that I am fearful that we have not got a systems integrated view to all of the energy generation and disposition, and that we run the risk of looking at this week's favorite solution. And we have to grapple with that problem. We have the computers to do it. We have the talent to do it. And that's something we're investing in at Battelle, because I worry that if you go down just one path, you'll have unintended consequences and there'll be ramifications that are negative. So that's the second thing we're doing. So what have I heard today? I've heard five points, I think. The first is it's a complicated problem. I've just mentioned that. The second is we need an increase of investment. And this is surely true. My caution here is that the investment increase has to be sustainable. It can't be a rapid up 2 years and a rapid down. Many of us have lived through that. I remember a famous story about IBM where the director of research went to the CEO and said, IBM's fortunes are going down, but please don't kill the R&D, because you can get rid of a world-class group over a weekend, but it takes decades to build them. And the CEO said, good point, and the R&D budget stayed less damaged. And when IBM's fortunes went way back up, he went back and asked for a lot of money, and the CEO said, I remember you. He said, and what you said then was also true. you know. So rapid increases have to be very carefully managed, but my main concern is that they be sustainable. You put together teams of people, teaming with university students, and then suddenly the money goes away, bad things happen. So that's my thought on the increase. Creating robust partnerships amongst industry, academia, and national labs. Yes, absolutely. I have a slightly different view of this because we do it all the time, and I've heard a lot of angst, but every time we run a national lab, we do it with either a university partner or an industry partner. That's how we manage them. We always have a set of core universities, 7 to 10 at each laboratory. They're world-class universities. We also collaborate with institutions around the world, including Asia and European universities. Here in the States, we have over 3,000 industrial partnerships and contracts with Battelle and its labs. So certainly there are things that work, and I think we need to look at those and understand why they work and build on them, not just sort of say nothing works and we have to reinvent. Let's look at things that have worked, and I've got plenty of examples from Livermore, Oak Ridge, and the other Battelle labs of examples of technology that have in fact gone out from the labs to industry, with industry. In order to do that, you have to recognize incentives. You have to sort of say, what is the coin of the realm at each of these institutions that makes them tick? And that is doable, but certainly we need new tools to help us. Fourthly, rapidly transferring new technologies into the marketplace. And we need to be far more creative and innovative in our business practices. And I've recently taken a new look at this. We tend to think of innovation as being a widget, but actually sometimes the business direction you can pick or the business innovation can lead to better products. And it's an interesting lens to look through. Who would have thought we'd have been downloading music onto iPhones and iTunes and so on, or buying computers without ever handling them by doing it through, you know, electronic purchasing and so on. There's a lot of business innovations. We have a long list of our own, and that's an interesting lens to view innovation through, because it's not just the technical solution. Sometimes it's the business solution that goes along with it. I am speaking from experience here. Rapidly transferring technology into the marketplace is in our DNA at Battelle. We invented the Xerox copying machine, and that was in the 60s. And at that time, no one was interested in the patents. Everyone believed if you copied the Library of Congress once, you were done. They hadn't thought about multiple copies and other things. And that was a $500 million profit in that day. And Chester Carlson picked up about a third of it. We picked up two-thirds of it and lost our nonprofit status. That's a different story. We regained it. We also invented the CD, barcodes, cruise control, a bunch of things. So we're very interested in how technology gets into the marketplace. And by the way, when we make a profit, we invested in two things. We invested in education, and we invested in our own R&D funding, including a venture fund, which we have, which is $250 million. And that is a high-risk bet we placed. So I listened carefully to your words, because we told our board that we would make a significant return on that investment. And it's nervous-making betting on ventures. We've spun out 26 companies. And if you're afraid of failure, don't get into that game, because some of them just flat out fail and you have to know when to get out. So we're very interested in venture and leveraging and all the things that go with it. Now, how do we improve getting technologies out of the labs to industry? Well, the first thing to do is ask industry, how easy is it to work with us? And the answer is it's not easy enough. There are too many barriers and it's too challenging sometimes to break through, but it does happen. At Livermore and Sandia, we attracted $250 million of cash from Intel for something called submicron lithography. So again, if you have the technologies and you're willing to work it, they were frustrated with working with three labs. It was Livermore, Sandia, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. So we solved that problem by taking one person and saying, that's the entry into the three labs. We then discovered there was more than one Intel, or quite a few of them. So we said, you like that model, so do we. who's the person we're dealing with, and then they go back as a scout back into the company and deal with all the language and social issues that they understand far better than I. So there are mechanisms, there are models that have been tried that I think could help in this regard, but we need better IP practices. That's the hurdle that causes the biggest problem for us. When we go off and try to, you know, do business across the country, even amongst our labs, amongst industries, intellectual property constraints are often very, very difficult to negotiate. I think sometimes we are afraid of success. I do. When I was at Livermore helping start with the Craders of the early 92s, when we were successful, we got into trouble. So here's a fundamental problem. If you're paid by the federal government and you help a section of a commercial enterprise be successful, that's perfectly legal and it's encouraged. But if you're successful, it means somebody else is getting less market share than you are. By definition, they almost are. And when they wake up and realize their tax dollars going to a laboratory that's helping their competitor put them out of business, they say, I know how to solve this. I'll tell my congressman and launch into DOE. That's the observation I had. When you take market share, when it's a real transfer of technology and there's real market share being created, then you're going to have the stomach to deal with the reality of that. And so you cannot be afraid of success, because with it comes tough decisions, and it looks like you're picking winners even if you're not, and you have to be willing to deal with that. I'm optimistic that my former laboratory director colleague, Stephen Chu, understands these issues. He went through them for several years, and I'm sure he's going to find new ways of producing solutions. Final point, workforce of the 21st century. This has been discussed a little bit today, but here's my view. I'm a baby boomer. Since we're disclosing age, I'm 58. So I'm right in the middle of a bubble that's going through our workforce. Bottom line, 40% of our workforce is retirement eligible in the next 5 to 7 years. That's the bottom line. Data is freely available. There are some mitigating circumstances. We're healthier as we get older. We want to work longer. But nonetheless, that's a big number. If you have a lab of 10,000 people, that means 4,000 are going to be gone in 5 years. And where are they coming from to be replaced? Well, what's the replacement term? Well, it's U.S. universities. Still the best universities in the world, but the numbers just aren't there. Foreign nationals, they're not staying as long as they did. So you've got an increasing pull term and two decreasing source terms, and that's a train wreck. So when we look at our philanthropic purposes, we invest in STEM schools. And there's a lot of interest in doing that. Bill and Melinda Gates are investing with us. They've asked us to help spend some of their money to try and inject some change into the education system. But all of us who study this problem, you know, all roads lead back to Rome. It's a K through 12 issue. It's a pre-K issue. I wonder where it stops. Somewhere we've got to increase the number of people coming into our workforce. I understand the international argument. We're building a laboratory in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. Petronas asked us to design, build, and operate that lab. We're doing that. They're paying us. It's wonderful. We have an international workforce, but that's only a piece of the problem. Homegrown or home-retained people are vital for our future. So those are my 5 points. In summary, I'd like to thank you for inviting me. I'd like to thank all the participants. I learned a lot. I hope you did. And most of all, I'd like to thank the people who showed up, because they're interested in one of the most important problems of our time. Mark, would you like to conclude?
And these are important thoughts for all of us to consider as the nation prepares to act boldly in this Congress. With that, I would like to draw this afternoon to a close with first an infomercial and then a thought. The infomercial first. I just wanted to encourage all of you who'd like to continue to be updated about future discussion of this proposal and others related in the coming year to email us or leave your cards in the bowls in the lobby, and we'll keep you apprised. I also want to let you know that the full-length and abbreviated papers, Jim Duderstadt's PowerPoint, video clips, MP3 files, and other related materials are now posted or will be tomorrow at
www.blueprintprosperity.org. As for the final thought, it's this. It seems like one thing we've heard today very clearly is that we need to invest more, probably much more, in the energy sector transformation, but we also need to invest differently. We can't simply do more of the same. That's been repeated over and over. We need to do more, but do some of it in very new ways. In that sense, I think we're all agreed that a serious discussion of the work before us needs to start in earnest right away. So with that, let me thank all of you, speakers, panelists, especially you in the audience, and thanks again. So thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.